We're seeing people that are convicted of burglary, and these people are walking back out on the street within a year.
Criticism for a state plan to release dozens of nonviolent offenders from custody. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congress highlights ongoing problems with the Air Force F-35 squadrons.
Pilots weighing less than 136 pounds will not fly the F-35 due to a high risk of serious injury that could result from having to eject.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce two new bachelor degrees, Alaska Native Governance and Creative and Professional Writing. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Governor Bill Walker says he would consider removing a natural gas reserves tax from this month's special legislative session agenda, but only if the state's partners in the Alaska LNG pipeline project can negotiate an acceptable replacement by Friday. The state is partnering with ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips on the project, which would bring natural gas from the North Slope to the Kenai Peninsula for export. Walker has been pushing for a withdrawal agreement to ensure the project could go forward, even if one partner decides to pull out. When the partners failed to come to an agreement earlier this fall, he proposed the reserves tax, which would dock companies for any natural gas left in the ground. The other big issue on the agenda is whether or not the state should buy out its fourth partner, the pipeline builder TransCanada. The governor has not yet released specific legislation for either issue, a delay which has irritated the legislature's Republican majority. The governor's staff has had scheduled a five-hour briefing on gasline issues for all 60 lawmakers Saturday afternoon, but Republicans in the House and Senate have scheduled hearings for those times instead. Speaking with reporters on Wednesday, Walker said that's fine. His administration will hold the briefing at 8 a.m. Saturday for whichever lawmakers want to attend. He said the legislation will be ready by the start of the session. A State Department of Corrections plan to release nonviolent prisoners and put them on electronic monitoring has raised alarm in Palmer. The community is home to the Palmer Correctional Center, and some residents fear there is not enough supervision available to support the move. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, yesterday a state legislator held a field hearing on the issue.
The State Department of Corrections may release 176 inmates to an ankle monitoring program. Corrections Department Commissioner Ron Taylor says the plan is driven by both state budget cuts and by a move toward prison reform.
The department has been focused on successful prisoner reentry. And so what we're trying to do is look for ways that we can assist people to be more successful so that they're not a public safety risk, or we lessen that public safety risk when they are returned to the community.
Taylor told the panel that it is not correct to term the plan early release, nor will it empty Palmer's minimum security facility.
The Palmer ramp down, as it's being referred to, is not necessarily the ramp down of Palmer minimum, nor is it the closure of Palmer medium. It's actually looking at all of our minimums across the state to determine who can we allow them to serve their sentence on electronic monitoring or halfway house or through some other fashion.
Taylor says legislative leadership has contacted his department to find ways to reduce inmate populations by 15% and then up to 25% to save costs. Taylor says Corrections is already working toward that goal, with more than 1,000 prisoners now on electronic monitoring or in halfway houses in 8 communities across the state. He told the panel that a prisoner in a hard bed or one housed in a state facility costs $142 a day. Taylor says ankle monitoring costs a little over $22 a day for each prisoner. But Representative Jim Culver, who called for and chaired the field hearing, had concerns about the criteria used to determine inmate eligibility for the monitoring plan and about its effectiveness.
A lot of other states had budget reductions and have gone through these kinds of things. And from some of the information that I've gathered, that they had an inmate that put the monitor on his dog and then went out and offended, and the Corrections Department went through a third-party vendor, and they thought the inmate was still in the house where he was supposed to be detained, but he was out committing crimes.
Taylor told him that Corrections does not use third-party vendors and currently has 446 inmates on electronic monitoring supervised by the Department of Corrections. Public Safety Commissioner Gary Folger also cited other states' problems with ankle monitoring. He said a Los Angeles County program failed to provide enough probation officers while homelessness shot up.
The liaison told me that the population of Skid Row had tripled. And so what I'm ultimately saying here is more than just any one department.
Others at the hearing voiced community concerns. Vicki Wallner, who maintains the website Stop Valley Thieves, says if offenders don't do actual prison time, they will reoffend.
And this is why people are so angry. We're seeing people that are convicted of vehicle thefts, of burglary, and these people are walking back out on the street within a year.
But Taria Walters, a former inmate at Highland Mountain, supports the monitoring plan.
And the reason why I say that is because I have lived within the system, and I see many, many individuals that could benefit from getting on the ankle monitor. They could get a job and pay their own rent, pay for their ankle monitor, and also start paying back the restitution and their fines.
Walters also told the panel about the extreme difficulty of finding housing after release from prison. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Two of the Fairbanks Four say they lied to police about some of what they did the October 1997 night John Hartman was attacked, but maintained they did so out of fear and confusion, not guilt. Kevin Pease and Eugene Vent took the stand yesterday at an ongoing evidentiary hearing to consider whether they and two others also convicted of the crime are innocent. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Kevin Pease told the court he resorted to a lie about being with his girlfriend the night John Hartman was fatally beaten on a downtown street because he had not tracked the time during a rambling night of partying and travel around the city.
I lied because I was scared. I lied because I wasn't there. And, you know, it was just, I knew everything was not going right, and I did not handle the situation correctly.
Eugene Vent, who'd also been drinking heavily during the night, including at a party with Pease, said he blacked out for part of it before being picked up by police. During questioning Tuesday by his attorney, Pease admitted to lying to police about some of the events of the evening, saying he confessed to involvement in the Hartman attack after police offered false evidence.
Tell me that there was blood and my footprints were in the blood numerous times.
Vent said he reconsidered his confession after sobering up.
I just realized that I wasn't with Marvin, I wasn't with George. I know I blacked out from 3 o'clock until I got arrested, and I got a chance to think. And I realized that there's no way that I could have done them like this.
Tuesday's testimony by Vent and Pease followed that of George Freeze last week. The other member of the Fairbanks Four, Marvin Roberts, has yet to take the stand. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a shell vessel rescues a French sailor in trouble in a remote stretch of the Pacific Ocean.
The man was holding onto the rigging at the very front of his sailboat and almost fell, which was kind of scary.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
The National Transportation Safety Board has released the results of an investigation into a 2013 airplane crash in Soldotna that killed 10 people. KDLL's Shailen Cochran has more.
The NTSB says too much unbalanced weight is the likely cause of the crash that brought down the de Havilland DHC-3 Otter in July of 2013. 42-year-old pilot Walter Willie Radisky of Nikiski and his passengers, Milton and Kimberly Antonakos and their three children, along with Dr. Chris and Stacy McManus and their two children, all of Greenville, South Carolina, died when the plane crashed shortly after takeoff. The new report confirms the preliminary studies the agency conducted that found the weight of the passengers and cargo wasn't properly accounted for ahead of takeoff. A video retrieved from a smartphone found at the scene helped investigators patch together what happened. The center of gravity for the plane at takeoff was too far aft or toward the rear of the plane. The end result was an aerodynamic stall, and the plane crashed 2,300 feet after takeoff. Officially, the NTSB says the probable cause of the accident was due to the operator's failure to determine the actual cargo weight. Additionally, the Federal Aviation Administration's failure to require weight and balance documentation also contributed to the crash. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
An environmental review is underway to determine whether Eielson Air Force Base will be the future home of two squadrons of F-35s. The Air Force is already flying the fighters in the lower 48, but after massive cost overruns and a 2014 engine fire, the aircraft remains controversial in Congress. The latest problems are with the ejection seat. At a U.S. House hearing today, Congressman Mike Turner, an Ohio Republican, says recent tests show the seat is dangerous for lighter weight pilots.
The specification for the ejection seat is that it needs to be able to accommodate a safe escape at pilot weights of 103 to 245 pounds. We understand that until this deficiency is corrected, pilots weighing less than 136 pounds will not fly the F-35 due to a high risk of serious injury that could result from having to eject.
General Christopher Bogdan says with the F-35 helmet on, the forces on the neck of a lighter pilot are too high, so they're trying to take some weight out of the tech-rich helmet.
We have been ongoing with the development of the new helmet and the new weight for about 6 months. It will take about another year for us to finish that to ensure that every helmet is less than 4.8 pounds.
They're also adding a switch to the seat that will adapt to the parachute launch for lighter pilots. Once the seat is up to specifications, the Air Force intends to allow pilots lighter than 136 pounds back in the cockpit. The Air Force already has several dozen F-35s. Another general at the hearing said one pilot was transferred because he didn't weigh enough to fly the F-35. The sole female F-35 pilot is still flying, apparently because she meets the temporary weight limit. The target date for the aircraft's arrival in Eielson is 2019. A little-known handbook for Alaskan women that details victims' rights and outlines practical ways to get out of abusive situations has been updated and, for the first time, published online. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield has more.
The Alaska Women's Legal Rights Handbook was first published more than 30 years ago. The latest edition, which was released last month, is 240 pages long and includes information on victims' rights, employment, reproductive rights, safety planning, and more.
It just gives women a broad, you know, overview on a broad array of legal topics that they could confront at any time in their life. And it's great that we're able to offer it online now, too, because, you know, anybody can access it at any time.
Christine Pate does legal advocacy work for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the organization that published the most recent edition of the handbook. She says the handbook is for anyone in the general public who is affected by domestic violence or sexual assault, but
I think there might be the question of why is it a women's legal rights handbook?
In a 2010 survey, 59% of Alaskan women reported experiencing intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both at least once in their lifetime. Anyone can be a victim of domestic violence, and the new handbook acknowledges violence in same-sex relationships. Pate says the information in the handbook is useful to any victim, but it is written using female pronouns.
A lot of the issues that are addressed here, women are the primary victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, and also our experience, and I think research shows that women, especially when there is a legal problem in perhaps a family law case, have less access to resources.
In communities off the road system with little or no law enforcement, the hurdles to leave an abusive situation are different. Ariel Herman, a training coordinator at ANDVSA, says that doesn't mean you can't prepare.
It's going to be different contextually, depending on if like you're in a village or in Juneau or Anchorage. But the idea of being ready to leave is something that we can all talk about, no matter where our context is.
The handbook includes a 7-page outline for creating a safety plan. It includes a section where the victim can write down important telephone numbers to their local police department or district attorney's office.
Where can you go? You know, who can you talk to? Not everyone feels comfortable talking to the police, so who else can they contact? And also, you know, we recognize that not every community has police. Your kids, do they know how to use the phone or radio in their community to know who to talk to and things like that?
There's a checklist for what the victim should consider taking with her before leaving. The list includes practical items such as social security cards for herself and her children, birth and marriage certificates, medications, credit cards, a checkbook, a copy of her divorce papers, or protective order. There's also things a victim might not think of in an emergency: jewelry, pets, photo albums, a child's favorite blanket or toy. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
Last month, a Georgia-based media group with several papers and magazines in Alaska misled readers with a controversial editorial. In a leaked corporate memo, a vice president at Morris Communications told papers it owns, including the Juneau Empire and Peninsula Clarion, to run a pre-written editorial and represent it as a local staff opinion. KSKA Zachariah Hughes is here to explain what happened. Hi, Zach.
Hey, Lori. So here are the basics. Last week, media blogger Jim Romanesco published a leaked corporate email from Morris Communications, which owns two dailies in Alaska, along with weeklies like the Chugiak Eagle River Star, Homer News, and the Alaska Journal of Commerce. The email is about an editorial that the company's CEO instructed local papers to run. This piece is saying that the Obama administration's decision to raise the number of Syrian refugees admitted to the U.S. is, quote, a potentially destructive act. Readers of the Juneau Empire or Peninsula Clarion would have seen this editorial on September 24th. And regardless of how you feel about immigration or the conflict in Syria, here's what's fishy about the editorial. Even though it looks like the local editors in either Juneau or the Peninsula wrote it, the words are exactly the same. So, Lori, would you read the title of the printout I just handed you?
Sure. It's a piece called Reckless Endangerment. It says it's a Peninsula Clarion editorial.
Yeah. And that same day, the Juneau Empire ran a piece headlined Editorial, Reckless Endangerment. And the first line reads, "Don't tell us America isn't compassionate." So, Lori, would you read the first sentence of the Peninsula Clarion version?
I will. It says, "Don't tell us America isn't compassionate." Exactly the same.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly the same. So is the rest of the piece. Same overall argument, same numbers, even a lot of the same rhetoric. Let me, in fact, give you some examples. It says the administration's policy is, quote, a step bordering on suicidal, and that these refugees come from a, quote, retrograde culture. And Lori, I mention that stuff because it's really strong language, right? Like, these are loaded terms and pretty strong opinions.
Zach, who wrote the corporate memo that gave these very exact instructions to the papers?
The email came from Morris's vice president for audience, Robert Gilbert. He didn't return any of my messages or emails. Nobody did, in fact. I should also add that almost nobody I contacted for this story was able or willing to speak on record, and that includes current and former staff for different Morris publications. It's actually why you and I are talking like this, Lori, because I have basically no tape that I can play for you.
Was there anyone who would go on record?
There was. There was one. Will Morrow, the news editor at the Peninsula Clarion, who told me that this was an extremely rare case, but was fairly straightforward and didn't get much discussion.
The editorial space generally reflects the views of the management and ownership of the paper. And in this case, you know, it came from a little higher up in ownership than our normal local editorials.
Zach, the Morris Group has used local editorial pages to make a political point previously. In 2013, a Morris CEO wrote an op-ed calling for a set-net ban right as all the company's Alaska-based papers started running a five-part series on salmon stocks. So how is this different?
In that case, the company clearly indicated whose opinion was appearing. The byline said William S. Morris III. With the reckless endangerment piece, the newspaper staff were told to make it look like their opinion, like local newspaper editors believed this. And that's just not the case. These were words and arguments coming from Georgia, not from Kenai or Juneau.
All right. Thanks for helping us understand this, Zach.
Thank you, Lori.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a three-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
What happens under Arctic sea ice has largely been hidden from the prying eyes of science. But a new under-ice trawl net has changed that. As KSKA's Monica Gokey reports, a study finds a northern cod species lurking there in the billions.
A new study by German researchers in the journal Polar Biology estimates the prevalence of nearly 9 billion Arctic cod in the eastern Arctic Ocean alone. They're a species that spends substantial time under the ice. 9 billion might sound like a lot, but Alaska fisheries scientist Franz Mutte, who's also surveyed for Arctic cod, says they've likewise found them by the billions living in the Chukchi. But
we didn't sample under the ice like they did, and that's the novel thing here is that they sampled under the ice in the central Arctic, which hasn't really been done much before.
The special net they used in the study was developed in the Netherlands. It sinks below the sea ice, and then inflatable floats bring it to the surface. Instead of trawling the bottom of the ocean, the net scrapes where ice meets ocean. It's new territory for science. Before the net, most surveying for Arctic cod was conducted in open seas, and that misses a key part of the species' life cycle. Arctic cod spawn under the ice. They actually lay their eggs there. And below the ice, juveniles find a nursery of sorts. There's plenty of zooplankton to eat. There's shelter from predators. And the study found 1 and 2-year-old fish under the ice, which was sort of surprising. In other parts of the Arctic Ocean, fish this age have already moved to the ocean floor. Muta again.
And these presumably, you know, stayed with the ice as the ice retreats, either because it's being pushed back to the north or because it, it melts and they just, move further under the ice that hasn't melted yet.
So under the sea ice, it's a good place to be a baby fish. And that's important for a little fish that shoulders the northern food chain.
The Arctic cod is probably the central or the most important prey species in the Arctic.
Seabirds, belugas, narwhals, seals, Arctic cod is a preferred food source for all those animals.
And so indirectly, they're quite important to subsistence hunters that depend on the mammals.
Though there isn't really a commercial fishery for Arctic cod for human consumption, after all, adults are only about 10 inches long, there is concern that an increasingly ice-free Arctic could lure fishermen north, especially as traditionally commercial fish species are likewise migrating north in search of cooler waters. Earlier this summer, Arctic nations agreed to a tenuous ban on unregulated fishing in the high Arctic. That is, until more surveys like this one can better assess fish stocks so they can be responsibly regulated. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Gokey.
This summer, Alaska Volcano Observatory scientists embarked on an ambitious project to repair seismic monitoring equipment at active volcanoes around southwest Alaska. Now, 176 of the observatory's 216 seismic stations are in working order. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
A backlog of deferred maintenance and lack of funding, coupled with the extreme nature of the environment, has caused some of the seismic monitoring stations to quit working over the past several years. This summer, crews were able to repair stations at a handful of sites in southwest Alaska. Janet Schaefer is with the Alaska Volcano Observatory State Geological Survey.
Then we're able to visit, importantly, Aniakchak Volcano on the Alaska Peninsula, restored some ground-based monitoring at the volcano there. And we also did seismic repairs at Gerloy, Tanagon, Westall volcanoes. Those are in the Aleutian Islands.
Schaefer says AVO was also able to fix stations at the recently active Shishaldin volcano. Funding came from the U.S. Geological Survey's Volcano Hazards Program. Future funding is uncertain, but Schaefer says the goal is to get more of their stations up and running.
Wrangell Volcano is an example. It has been active recently, and those stations are difficult to get to, so it would be nice to get there.
A volcanic eruption is often preceded by hours or even months of seismic activity, which Schaefer says provides AVO with valuable data.
So that we can detect those very small small magnitude earthquakes that indicate fluid movement either from an active hydrothermal system or gas or magma beneath the surface. So those are the first signs of unrest, and those are what really help us to be on guard.
And as more stations are brought back online, AVO can more reliably monitor volcanoes and issue more accurate warnings to the public as hazards to communities and passing air traffic become apparent. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A French sailor dove onto a Shell Oil icebreaker in 20-foot seas yesterday. He made the desperate jump with his cat about 350 miles southeast of Dutch Harbor. KUCB's John Ryan has the story.
Coast Guard video of the rescue shows the 30-foot sailboat bobbing like a cork next to the 270-foot Tor Viking. The Frenchman clings like a koala to the rigging at the bow of his boat. With a big backpack on and his cat stuffed inside his jacket, he times the waves just right. He dives over the rail of the icebreaker, landing headfirst with his feet flopping up in the air. Manu Watcom's ATN was sailing south after crossing the Northwest Passage in the Arctic Ocean this summer. His boat, La Chimere, passed through Nome about a month ago. The Tor Viking is an icebreaker tug. It's part of Shell's Arctic drilling fleet. The big bumblebee-striped tug was escorting Shell's Polar Pioneer rig down to Washington State. Shell gave up on its hunt for oil in the Arctic Ocean in September. Tuesday morning, the Shell ships heard the Coast Guard's call for help from any vessels near the struggling sailboat. Petty Officer Lauren Steenson is with the Coast Guard in Kodiak.
He reported that he had no rudder or rigging and was taking on heavy seas.
Steenson says the crew of the Tor Viking had to do some challenging maneuvering to get close to the tiny sailboat.
The man was holding onto the rigging at the very front of his sailboat and almost fell, which was kind of scary. But when one of the big waves came and kind of pushed him towards the boat, he kind of made a leap of faith onto the Tor Viking and made it.
On Facebook, Watcom's ATN says he's now en route to Seattle on board the Tor Viking. Shell spokeswoman Meg Baldino did not respond to requests for an interview. Watcom's ATN says his whole life was on his sailboat. Without it, he says he feels useless and without purpose, like a footballer who's lost a leg. In Unalaska, I'm John Ryan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Zachariah Hughes, Monica Goki and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and John Ryan in Unalaska. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Linfield College in Oregon offers degrees in the arts, sciences, and professional programs, and a rich campus life with athletics, music, study abroad, and more. Linfield College representatives are visiting area high schools in Anchorage, Kenai, and Fairbanks the week of October 20th. Learn more at linfield.edu. This message sponsored by Linfield College.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.